And now on to introduction here. Bradley Coon actually began his active work in the free software community just about 100 miles away from here. South of here is a graduate student at the University of Cincinnati. Since then, he has served as the executive director of the Free Software Foundation for 6 years. He formalized the GPL compliance program there and launched the associate membership program. Now he is serving as the president of the Software Freedom Conservancy, and which provides financial, administrative, and mentoring services to free software projects. It's a very important project. And also, he is the CTO of the Software Freedom Law Center, which provides pro bono services to free software and open source projects. Please give a big hand to Bradley Coon.
This issue of software freedom. It's a phrase that I really kind of like, even though it's a little grammatically incorrect. It used to be my job to walk around telling people to not say open source and to say free software. That's fortunately not my job anymore, but I think the term software freedom is great because it actually gets across the key idea, which is the issue of freedom. This whole thing about software freedom is, in fact, a movement. It's very interesting because it's a movement based in the end around a copyright license, a license that happens to be a constitution that defines what the rights and privileges and freedoms that software users ought to have. It's really important to think about that. The whole thing that we're involved with here happened because you got certain rights. You got the permission to do certain things with your software that for a very long time you didn't get the permission to do. In fact, this whole thing is on a collision course with the other side of the equation. The people who are using this copyright system and the patent system and all the legal infrastructure they can get their hands on to stop what we're doing. We're using that very legal infrastructure against them. So this is my old boss, who I used to work for, whom you all probably recognize. And this whole story actually starts with him. I don't work for him anymore, which means I like him a whole lot more than I used to. And he really was the first person to start thinking about this. And it all started for him like it does for most of us when we went to college. You go to college and you learn about the world. You learn, at least in the United States, it's generally what happens for people. They learn the things are beyond what they knew when they were in their little town in high school and so forth. They go out to a college campus and start to see what the world's about. And what Stallman saw when he went to college was really interesting stuff. Because, well, he didn't just go to college, he went to Harvard, which it's kind of interesting. Seems like an awfully sort of ivory towerish kind of place for Stallman to be. And it's not surprising that he, sitting there in Harvard on the one side of Cambridge, he wandered down the street towards the river and discovered the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, which is itself a very important institution, but a lot less stodgy and a lot less friendly with their computer time. So he got to spend a lot of time on computers at MIT when he was in college and decided once he left Harvard, what he wanted to do was work in that open, friendly, software sharing environment that was there in the AI lab at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. It was a really special time for computer science because it was an age of academic computing. There wasn't really a lot of corporate computing in the early 1970s. And what they did in that academic environment was do things that came natural to academics. So that included publishing your work and making it available. And there's this strange thing that's happened in computer science through the latter half of the last century in thinking that the way you published about computer science was to write academic papers about algorithms. That's one way that's important, but the other part of computer science is publishing the source code of your software. And that's what happened in this early 1970s world of academic computing. And there weren't really any legal infrastructure imposed on the software. It was shared around the academic community. And if you ever get a chance to hear Stallman, he'll tell even more about that. But the most important part of his story that he tells is when MIT began to change. That AI lab isn't there anymore. Now that happened really recently, but something else was going on inside it when it was still an active building. In the late 1970s, things changed for MIT and changed for academia. They discovered that they could use the legal system as a way to raise money for the university. They discovered that if professors applied for patents, that meant tons and tons of money for the university through licensing or through spin-off companies that went out and marketed and commercialized the stuff that they did. Now, there wasn't anything inherently wrong with commercializing these ideas. The problem was is that the way that they commercialized it was to create legal controls that didn't belong there on the software and technology that was being developed. And this whole idea of software licensing is an invention of the early 1980s. It didn't exist before then. People didn't license software. You got software along with purchasing a computer, and the software was almost an afterthought. It was put on the computer to make that big piece of iron that IBM convinced you to buy useful, because without software, it wasn't really that useful. So the whole idea of licensing was a concoction, an invention, that came about in the early 1980s. And there's been a lot of debate about who actually invented software licensing, and various people have various theories. Some think it happened because of this guy. This guy decided that he was going to do something really interesting. First of all, he was going to attack the community that shared software with his hobbyist letter, which I've sort of summarized for you there. And he also was able to convince IBM, strangely enough, that they didn't actually want to acquire his company. That instead, what he wanted IBM to do was to pay him a license for every computer they sold. Now, there must be some lawyer at IBM who got fired for this, because IBM would have done a lot better if they just acquired DOS from Microsoft, but they didn't. So then we have the world of software licensing. And this is actually the first time certain types of things began to happen with software that hadn't really happened before. This idea that you get a binary of the program and don't get the source code is a relatively new idea at this point. It's not something that really existed so much before then. In fact, one of my colleagues at the SFLC named Richard Fontana had this interesting observation that, in fact, this is the first introduction of digital restrictions management, or DRM, into the world of copyright, into the world of software. It's really sort of a rudimentary form of giving somebody this binary that's all jumbled up, because that's what the computer understands, and not giving them the natural, human-readable version of the program. And for those of us who grew up in the 1980s, or sort of had our formative years in the 1980s, software was a thing that we got as binary. I had a Commodore 64 that was only given to me with binary code. Sure, I could write my own programs, generate my own source code, but all the programs I got didn't have source code, and I never got to learn from the great programmers of my age. I never got to see their work and study it and learn more until when I got to college in 1991 and was able to download the first copy of the Linux kernel and start to look at it. But I shouldn't have had to wait that long. And we have to remember, those of you that are young in the audience, realize the fact that if you were, you know, 10 years younger than me, you had the Linux source code from the time when you could actually begin to read it, you know, when you're 14, 15, getting into computers. And that's something we've brought back that didn't exist for a long period because of this idea of software licensing. So what my old boss tried to do was to create a world where that stuff existed again. And so he starts this whole GNU project to get that done. And a really important component of it was done by some lawyers that helped him. Because the whole idea of distributing software that gives you various different rights and freedoms doesn't work if the legal system is working against you all the time. And as it stood in the late 1980s, that's how it was working. So you had to invent something, a legal tool, that would stop the legal system from working against you to make it work for you. So what the GPL, this constitution, does is takes that legal infrastructure and uses it against itself, uses it as a defense against the idea of proprietorization and using copyright law and patent law to squash software and stop it from being available and stop it from being shared. GPL turns that around and takes it back. And I always go through this slide in all my talks still, because even though we've probably all heard that, you heard it this morning in Max's talk, and I'm glad he brought it up, and I'm going to go through it again, simply because I believe that these are so important. These things are what makes our community happen. And we got to keep reminding ourselves, like a mantra, of why these things matter. The most important thing you get with software is the right to study it, the right to enhance the knowledge of humankind by learning from what other people have done before you. You get the right to share it with your friends. You get the right to allow others to have the same goodness of software that you do. And you have the right to make it better if you want to. And once you've made it better, you have the right to give those away. These things are fundamental, and that's the reason this thing worked. It didn't work for any other real reason other than this. All this other stuff about business adoption and better markets and more efficient code, it all comes from these four things. And they're embodied in that license. And that license actually has legal teeth because it uses the system that's there to make sure that you get all those freedoms. And that's really important. You know, I don't have to be a total GPL bigot anymore, because we have a client base at the SFLC that's GPL, we have BSD projects, we have ISC licensed projects. But I tend to still prefer the GPL because it's the one license that can really use the legal system to defend people's rights and freedoms. So this project throughout the 1980s is primarily a software project. It's writing software, getting more freedom out there. And throughout the 1990s, we still had to do that because, you know, Stallman didn't do it alone, right? There are so many other important free software programs that had to happen and had to come into existence for the whole thing to work. But we got there, right? By the end of the 90s, we've actually scared Microsoft, which is really kind of a neat thing, that people sharing and working together are able to scare the biggest, most powerful corporation ever to come into existence. So meanwhile, I'm walking on my path, right? So I start getting involved. I'm, you know, right here from, well, not from Ohio, but I went to graduate school here. You know, and I get to graduate school, and I go to graduate school because I hate writing and supporting proprietary software for a living, which is what I did out of college. I said, well, okay, I'll go to school because then I won't have to do that anymore, and I'll go hide in academia for a while. And then I discovered, when I got to graduate school, that you didn't really have to do much work when you were a grad student, at least for a while. So you had all this free time to sort of do whatever you felt like, so I just started volunteering for the FSF. And by 2001, I actually had a job full-time, which I went and moved to Boston to do, which was pretty cool. And it turned out that I showed up in the office just 3 months before Microsoft decided to launch the largest smear campaign against free software that it ever undertook. So I'm, you know, a green kid, you know, I mean, I don't know anything about the press or any of this stuff. And all of a sudden, you know, we're getting, the phone's ringing off the hook. I got four people there answering the phone for, you know, the press suddenly interested in this stuff. Because what happened is Microsoft decided to be preemptive, decided to attack this thing before it gets too big. And so they start using all these terms out there in the world and saying all these horrible things. For example, un-American, which was very strange to me because I had just sort of lived the American dream. I'd gotten my dream job working at the Free Software Foundation, all because I knew something about the GPL. So that seemed pretty American to me. And then just other random things that Bill Gates says, you know, about what this stuff is and how bad it is. So this huge press machine comes descending upon open source and free software, which actually turned out to be the best thing in some ways that ever happened to us. Because up until that time, the letters GPL didn't appear much in the media. And suddenly, we were getting calls from the New York Times to do a front page story, at least on the business page, not the front page of the paper, talking about the GPL and why Microsoft hated it. So it's really kind of this press error that Microsoft made. In the way they picked the best time, right? Because our software wasn't there yet, right? I mean, GNOME had just started a couple years before. They really weren't there as a desktop yet. We didn't have a lot of the things we needed. We didn't have a working, really good sound system. We didn't run on laptops that well at all. All these things that were true, you know, 7 or 8 years ago, was really setting us up for this unfortunate time that Microsoft could kill us while we were young, in a way. But it turned out to be the worst time because Microsoft gave us all this interest when we really didn't warrant that interest yet, because we really hadn't gotten into the businesses and so forth yet. So I think it turned out really well for us. But then the dot-com bust happened right afterwards, and there was this change in the software industry. Proprietary software companies had, you know, sort of sprouted up to do vertical market stuff on the internet, and if you had internet in your IPO, suddenly your stock price was selling high for a while there. But in the end, they started to really struggle. And a lot of them were trying some of this open source stuff. And Caldera, which I don't know why they pronounced it Caldera, because it's actually Caldera, right? But anyway, so they decided to try this Linux stuff as their way to get involved and so forth. And then they hire this CEO who, I didn't believe it was his name at first, but I think it actually is. But I don't know why they hired a CEO out of a James Bond movie. I mean, this guy's like the classic James Bond villain, Ransom Love. So he says, okay, well, what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna buy up the old PC Unix market. SCO pretty much had a corner on the market of Unix running on PCs in those days, pretty much through all the 80s and most of the 90s. And he says, well, I'll buy that up. It's a small market because most people are running Unix on other types of platforms, but since Linux runs on PCs and that used to run on that, that's a way to consolidate the market. And he actually tries to get out there and make a replacement, you know, for SCO and integrate Linux and SCO in some sort of way. Well, it didn't really work in the end. They didn't get anybody really that interested. There was just such a disconnect between people who were doing this proprietary SCO Unix on PCs and people who were doing Linux. And in the end, his board fired him. And the board, heavily influenced by this really kind of creepy VC group called the Canopy Group out in Utah, they find their new golden boy in this guy, Daryl McBride, as we see pictured here in his rugged looking, take over the world kind of scary, whatever that is. And he said, well, I need a business plan, right? This thing didn't work. Ransom Love didn't succeed at, you know, doing whatever it was he was going to do. Oh, but as a side note, I was on a conference call right after this, all this stuff happened, and a reporter asked a question. It was on these PR conference calls, like, what is Ransom Love going to be doing now that he's not working on the Linux initiative anymore? And the press person said with a straight face, Ransom Love has never worked on our Linux initiative. And I expected her next to say, we have always been at war with Eurasia. It's bizarre. So they trot Daryl McBride out. He's got a new business plan. Well, what's his business plan? Lawsuit as business model, right? He doesn't know how to market anything. He doesn't have anything he understands. The guy doesn't understand Linux, obviously. He didn't even understand the SCO technology that they had bought up. So he decides, well, we've got to have something, right? We have Unix. Linux is Unix, right? So we have to have something, so let's sue somebody for using Linux. So they decide, well, who's the biggest guy using Linux? IBM, let's sue them. So that's the business model that comes out of this. And what ends up happening is this weird kind of scam. Now, we all saw this as a scam, and I actually pulled this off Slashdot a couple of months after the SCO thing started, and we all understood this. Like, this is bullshit, right? This is not real. You know, this 70 lines of code that he has is not really anything. It turns out it's like the old code from S-Break that Dennis Ritchie wrote in 1978 and published in the public domain in his book. Oh, wow, yeah, that's in Linux, too. Yeah, it was in the public domain. And we were a little bit worried, right? But we didn't really think he had anything, and we had expected this all along anyway. We knew that eventually somebody was going to sue somebody over open source and free software. It was bound to happen at some point. And we in the free software sort of political side had always thought eventually it's going to happen. We didn't really know what we were going to do if it did. And of course we knew Microsoft would get involved. What they did in this case is they bought a license for all the SCO technology for a lot of money that didn't seem like they really needed technology given how much they hate Unix, but they had as much money as they wanted to bankroll this whole effort. They'd already tried the PR campaign and it had failed. They decided, well, we'll proxy a litigation shop through SCO and see if we can sue this Linux stuff out of existence. But the strange thing was is that SCO was suing IBM, which is pretty much the one company in the world, at least in the tech world, that you usually don't want to sue. So I've learned a lot about the whole law firm world since I went to work for the Software Freedom Law Center in all era. All our lawyers are generally like so these law firm refugees or like I've finally been set free from the law firms and can work somewhere sane. So IBM's law firm is this big, giant monolith of a litigation shop called Crevasse, Swain & Moore. And it's been around for decades. It's they do not settle a lawsuit. They just spend you out of existence. And now I'll get on to who my current boss is, who at this moment realizes how lucky we've become. Because he said that this suit was definitely coming. We all knew that. And we were always worried it was going to be somebody suing the FSF. I mean, looking back now, it seems kind of stupid because I don't think anybody will ever sue the FSF or any sort of small free software related nonprofit. But the worry was, well, we didn't have enough money to pay for a lawsuit, but SCO decided to sue the people that had the most money to fight the lawsuit. So SCO handed us the checkbook of IBM to fight the lawsuit that we knew was coming and didn't know how we were going to fight. So that was a pretty lucky break for us in the end. But it didn't mean that we just got off the hook right away. There was still a ton of work and a ton of sort of response that had to happen. We actually got subpoenaed by SCO, because we're a witness to this crime, right? Or not a crime, but it was a civil litigation, but we're a witness to this terrible thing that IBM had done to SCO. FSF was a witness while this terrible thing happened. So the service processor was kind enough to let us take his picture. He was, as you can see in the shot, he was totally confused why we wanted a picture taken of us being served with a subpoena. But of course, I knew this was like the, I did a lot of what I did at FSF was fundraising. I started the associate membership program. I knew this was like membership signups in the bank, right? Because people are gonna say, oh, FSF was was subpoenaed by SCO. We better give them some money. So it was all for me. That's why I'm smiling in the picture, right? But then we figured we better take sort of a serious one. We've been subpoenaed by SCO, so this is the serious one that we took. And this subpoena, I don't know if you all have read it back. We put it on the website, I think, at the beginning of 2004. It was, they wanted every document that we had ever communicated about or written about that related to GPL enforcement, anything that Stallman had ever said to Linus Torvalds ever in his life, and anything that Stallman or Eben or any of us had said to any distributor of anything called Linux ever. A little side note, I didn't put on the slide, but they, throughout the subpoena, they kept calling us the Free Software Trade Association, which I never understood. Like somebody must have it was like they went and replaced free and it expanded to free trade or something. I've never figured that out. I asked our lawyers does that mean we don't have to answer it because it's for the Free Trade Software Association? They said, no, we have to answer it. It's for us. And it turns out to answer it, you get about $50 and they pay your fees for whatever like photocopying or anything you need to do. So it was obviously going to be more expensive than that to actually answer the subpoena. So I got kind of worried, but being a good, honest hacker geek, I said, well, what's a sort of open source kind of way? Well, I guess I work for FSF. What's a free software kind of way to answer the subpoena? So I started playing with spam filtering. I said, well, what does a spam filter do? It uses this Bayesian system, right, to see, is this message something I like or something I don't like? I said, okay, well, I can go through an entire giant mail spool because Stallman has all his email all the way back to 1996, which means it was all subject to the subpoena. So I've got to go through all this email archive that Stallman had, plus all to the GNU at GNU.org, which I used to answer in my early days at FSF. So there's all this email archive. I said, okay, let me start training iteratively this Bayesian filter and say, this is subject to subpoena, this is not. And I did about 5 or 6 iterations of this over, it took me about a week just sort of playing with it. And I actually got really good results. Like it was actually starting to turn out, okay, this stuff that was ending up in the ham folder was stuff that, the lawyer looked at and said, oh, that would be subject to subpoena. And the stuff that was in the spam folder was stuff that was not subject to the subpoena. So I think I may be the only person who ever answered a subpoena using a spam filter, which is kind of cool. Now, I never got to, unfortunately, because it never went to litigation, I would have been called as a witness, right? And I would have had to explain how I answered the subpoena and stuff, which never actually happened, but would have been fun. But we did generate 5 reams of paper. And of course, even though we had it electronically, we put it all on paper, so they had to scan it back in on the other side, because you don't want to spot them the technology, right? So I think that these giant boxes of paper are still sitting in a warehouse, you know, at David Boies' place somewhere now. I don't think anybody actually ever read this. There was actually a rather damning email that I sent regarding, you know, sort of proprietary drivers in Linux to Stallman, and saying, oh, does Linus going to actually use the GPL for this or whatever? And the lawyers picked that one that I had sent as the, they always pick a smoking gun of like, this is the worst thing we have to send to them. And I got the honor of having the worst email to send to SCO, but I don't think they ever looked at it. So the problem was that even though I was able to do this pretty quickly and we were able to answer the subpoena and we got some good fundraising out of it, there was some real harm done by SCO. And I think the biggest harm that it did was it set back adoption of Linux. And I don't know how we would actually tell, you know, because we can't sort of run a, you know, alternate universe or anything, but by the level of kind of press it was getting and stuff, I think probably there was probably about 2 years, excuse me, 2 years in there that we lost of adoption because of the whole SCO thing. I don't have any proof for that, but it's just sort of what my gut has said about how it did. But I actually had a bigger problem with it, was just how much time it wasted of all of us reading all these news stories and sort of following the blow by blow. It was sort of like this tabloid kind of effect that we just heard about in the last speaker. And I just have thought about, you know, how much more free software we had if we just hadn't spent all our time reading about SCO. And it kind of makes me sad. You know, it's funny, but it's funny sad, right? So the reason, the interesting thing for us, we actually had a good time with this, as you can tell, sort of telling the story. We actually really were enjoying the whole thing because being at FSF in those days, we weren't really worried for ourselves, because for years and years and years, much to the chagrin of many open source and free software developers, FSF had arduously collected paperwork for every single contribution that had been made to an FSF copyrighted program. And if you go back in time to a conference 10 years ago, you'll find people making fun of me and everybody else for, oh, FSF, it's so hard to contribute to their projects. Well, when SCO started, we said, ah, we're in good shape, because every single developer who's contributed to an FSF copyrighted program had to assent that it was their work, that their employer didn't own it, that they were not aware of any patents that read on it. So, you know, we had lots of assurances and lots of assignments of copyright that made it clear that sitting around in the GNU code base, there was really unlikely to be any SCO stuff. Now, the kernel guys really had to sweat the whole thing, because they did not know for sure. And I think, in all honesty, they just got lucky, because it just turned out that nobody ever sent a patch that actually was something from some real Unix source code and nobody noticed and got included. And I think that there's a lot of work to be done in all, not just Linux, I mean, I don't want to single them out, all the open source and free software projects to really begin to collect good data about who's contributing and who their employer is and whether or not their employer has a work for hire agreement, you know, whether it's work for hire that they're doing, whether their employer has some sort of further agreement that they own all their stuff. And I like the signed off by tag that Linux has, but it's only really a beginning. There's got to be a lot more work to be done. And I think it's the onus is on us to give easy methods to these guys to make it easy. We don't want to make it harder to contribute to open source software by any means. But we do need to work together, you know, as a community to come up with better methods to get better auditing of contributions and stuff. And that's just on the copyright side, right? On the patent side, it's even a little bit more frightening. Now, we got lucky again, because it turned out that SCO didn't actually have any patents that read on Linux at all. They had one or two patents that weren't even for operating system technology, strangely enough. Some lawyer at SCO probably got fired. Well, they all got fired because they went bankrupt. But, you know, somebody at SCO wasn't on the ball in the late 1980s, you know, and throughout the 1990s, you know, filing for patents so that they could get lots of patents that they could later use for Dell McBride's litigation as business model strategy. But if there had been SCO patents, that would have been a nightmare, because, you know, you don't know if a patent reads on something when you write it. In fact, if you're not a patent attorney, you can't figure out if a patent reads on the work you just wrote. And you could independently generate some work, and it turns out the patent actually covers it, even though you thought of it as your own idea, because somebody applied for a patent last week. So we have to really think about how to protect this future of software freedom in the face of the giant patent pools that are sitting out there. And we've done some work in GPL v3, but you know, we're not GPL bigots per se in the Software Freedom Law Center. We recommend it to a lot of our clients, but some clients aren't GPL. So we have to think about across the whole space, all the way from the ISC license to GPL v3 and everything in between, how do we protect from patents? And that's a huge challenge that we're facing. And now there's also the issue of that legal teeth aspect of the GPL. When I was at FSF, I was personally involved with a whole lot of GPL enforcement cases. There was a lot of GPL violation out there, and it's a lot that goes unreported on top of that. And even today, I'm still doing sort of the same work I was doing 10 years ago with GPL enforcement. If you look at our website, you'll see a lawsuit that the Software Freedom Law Center filed on behalf of one of our clients, BusyBox, against a GPL violator. It's the first lawsuit on the GPL filed in the United States. And there's going to be more enforcement to do as time goes on, because there's more and more people who don't know the rules. And the important thing that we have to do is teach people how those rules work, how they respect freedom. And one of the reasons we've been so successful in the GPL enforcement we have done is because we've always said the most important thing is to comply with the license and respect the community and give the community the source code. That's the number one goal of every GPL enforcement effort in the world, by and large, that's been done, at least by nonprofit entities. And that continues to be the thing that we're helping our clients do, and there's a lot more of it to do. So I think when I look at adoption of free software and try to figure out, you know, so what's left, what's stopping adoption now? I mean, now that SCO's over, that's not an impediment to adoption anymore. And I think there's only one thing left that is a real showstopper for free software taking over computer science in general. And that's digital restrictions management. And for a very simple reason, because we've beaten proprietary software on pretty much everything. You know, back when they started the Microsoft PR campaign against open source and free software, we didn't have OpenOffice, we didn't have a working sound system, as I mentioned. There were so many things that were broken in the free software stack, and now that's all fixed. You know, it's pretty hard to, you know, not give a Linux box to your grandma now, because all the stuff that she needs is there, just like it's there in Windows. But the one thing that Vista provides, right, the one upgrade, as it were, that you got when you switched from XP to Windows Vista was DRM. That's the one thing that the proprietary software companies can still offer their customers that the free software world just can't, because we're on a collision course with DRM, because you can never truly implement DRM in an open source way. But that's not really a scary tale, in my opinion, because the MPIA and the RIA are really, really failing at this. Remember back, you know, 3 years ago, they said they were going to file a lawsuit every day if they had to stop all file sharing ever that ever happened? Yeah, they stopped filing lawsuits at least a year and a half ago. They occasionally file one and try to get some press for it, and nobody cares, and they don't go anywhere. Meanwhile, their member companies are starting to realize, well, gee, we don't really need DRM to get what we want done. This is a really interesting thing that happened earlier this month. My wife's really into, she's like a television critic, she's really into television, and she was like, I was like, we were watching the fall shows, and she said, oh, I saw that pilot already. I said, what are you talking about? And she said, oh, well, you can download all the pilots, and they're not DRM'd. Because what NBC cares most about is not, you know, the issue of whether or not you pay for a particular show. You can even see it before it aired. They don't care. What they really care about is you getting into that show. They really want a buzz about a show. Save the cheerleader, save the world, and everybody watches Heroes the next day, right? And if you want to watch it the minute it airs so you can talk about it at the water cooler the next day, well, you're going to have to watch it with commercials. They know that they only make the real money in TV when you watch it the first airing, because we've had video cassettes since the 1970s. People could always record and watch it later. But the key thing that NBC wants is for you to watch it the moment that it airs. So you can IM your friends and say, Hero just went back in time, or whatever it is. I hope I'm not spoiling Heroes for anybody. But even more importantly than all this stuff, that the media companies are actually getting a clue and they're realizing DRM's not in their interest anymore, is this key issue. The little devices that play videos, that play music, that make this stuff happen, it's got Linux in it. These devices are going to have our stuff in it, and it's going to be open sourced, and it's not going to be able to implement DRM. And every time a new device comes out, the hardest part of getting it to market is the software, and we've got a whole range of software ready to go into every little device that's going to play a movie for you while you're on the subway. The other issue in this whole thing is the fact that I'm finally realized that I'm old, at least a little bit, because I own a TV and I use it in the standard way. I watch Heroes, right, and when it airs in the normal kind of way. But the 23-year-olds I know don't actually have TVs. They all buy projectors and just download everything they want to watch and project it on the side wall of their apartment. And they don't really run into this whole DRM question that used to be this big thing because it's so circumventable and nobody's actually bothering with it. Now, we have a lot of education work to do, and I think it's great that my old organization I used to work for is doing this work. And I'm actually admittedly a little bit jealous because it's really fun to do these kind of campaigns, and I think they're wonderful. And what really has to happen, though, in addition to this, is somebody's got to do the boring stuff. And that's actually what we're doing. You know, the funny thing, it's really, you know, the whole idea of actually getting this stuff done, there's so much work that nobody wants to do. Because the whole code sharing stuff, that's the fun part. The getting and meeting people all over the world, contributing to your project. But then on the back end, that makes the whole legal stuff, the organizational stuff, really, really difficult. The reason the whole SCO thing was so frightening for everybody was because we weren't sure that we had all the legal ducks in the row. We didn't know. We got really lucky. You know, people ask me why I still talk about SCO when it's over, they're bankrupt, because I actually believe that if you don't pay attention to history, you're condemned to repeat it. We got lucky, period. We have to get good about this stuff, and we realize it's really, really boring work and hard work and stuff that's no fun to do. We want you guys to do the fun stuff. You can write the software. I'm enough of a masochist that I want to do the boring stuff. I want to do the stuff that nobody else wants to do, and everybody I work with likes doing that stuff. Lawyers love generating documents and writing stuff down and taking records about things. None of you guys like to do that. I know that, by and large. But we're going to try to do it for you because we don't want anything to ever go wrong. We want to have all the documentation, all the clarity on the history of all our software so that if somebody questions its copyright pedigree, we can answer that it is fine. And if we do run into those problems, we can fix them. The key thing is constant vigilance. That is the answer to solving these problems, and it's really annoying to have to do. So I just want to talk, I got two more slides to talk just briefly about the kind of services that we're providing. What SFLC does is pro bono legal services for clients, for anybody who's a FOSS project in a nonprofit way. So we deal with things like, you know, people are like, oh, does this patent read on my work? And what if they try to sue us for patent infringement, or will companies adopt it if there's a patent out there? We do a lot of copyright diligence stuff. If you look at our website this week, you'll find a lot of work we did for the AF5K driver for the Linux wireless team, making sure that their copyrights were in order and correct. And we just do things like code provenance, looking at the history of the code and making sure that everybody who contributed had a right to contribute, that they contributed under the correct license, that everything's good. Another big thing we do, as I've talked about, is the GPL enforcement stuff. I mean, this is the interesting thing about the relationship with FSF. I mean, all the guys who were there used to work for me, but now I still get to work with them in this service kind of way. We do the legal services for FSF as well as lots of other projects that have GPL stuff that needs GPL enforcement work done, and we collaborate with them. Some of the interesting, this is a very specific thing we're doing, is with the FCC issues related to wireless cards, because if you make an open source or free software driver all the way down to the bottom for a modern wireless card, you're actually able to control the radio and change it and send it out of range. So we've got a white paper on our website that talks about these FCC, what are called software-defined radio issues, and we're going to continue to follow that and try to work on that issue. And just generally, we want to make sure that no one can ever call into question the idea about open source and free software. We want it to be the case that forever and always people can feel confident that this stuff is legally clear, legally safe, and you should use it. I'm also involved with a project that's closely tied to the SFLC called the Software Freedom Conservancy, and that's basically everything that's not legal services. It basically is the idea of creating a national park of open source and free software. You can go and have it taken care of. We want people to be able to make tax-deductible, at least in the US, donations to open source projects. It should be really easy for open source projects to get that. Right now, it's really hard. You've got to get a board of directors, you have to incorporate, you have to apply to the IRS, you have to wait 6 to 8 months for an IRS to answer, you have to wait another 3 months while you answer their answers, and so forth. What we've done is set up a tax-exempt charity that projects can join, and then once they've joined, they can receive donations, and we take care of all the sort of financial details for them as far as getting their bank account set up and allowing them to get money out of the organization and so forth. And basically anything related to administrative overhead. We've done sort of some minor conference stuff for people, negotiating contracts for things like this. You know, a project wants to have a conference like this. There's a lot of, Joe could tell you all the contracts they have to negotiate and details they have to do. We're doing some of that work. But sort of the most important part and the best part of it is to really help projects and give them real stewardship over the long haul. We've set up a board of directors at the Software Freedom Conservancy that includes a number of different well-known open source and free software developers who have started many projects, seen them through to be, you know, available and working well, handed them off to other people, done that transition, and made them live for a very long time. And basically, every project, if it's good, should have that ability. A lot of people, when they start a FOSS project, they think, well, I'm always going to be doing this, so it's fine, I don't have to worry. But you often want to move on to the next project. People who are good at starting projects aren't always the best people to finish them and continue them. So we want to help projects set up a longevity where they can be mentored and new leaders can come into the community and we can help them do that. I want to close by saying there's a really important thing happening. This is actually a really big thing that you're all involved with. This is as important as the invention of the movable type printing press in 1450. Now, it took a century or two, maybe a little longer, for people to actually have what books brought them. The Renaissance doesn't happen for a long time after the invention of movable type. And we're stuck in this moment right after the invention. The digital computer was just invented 60 to 70 years ago, give or take. So we've got a lot of time to go, and we've got to really make sure that these old legal systems, the copyright system, the patent system, that are designed for industries that are really as old as the printing press, to not get in our way and stop us from advancing the state of the art of computer science and what computers can do for people. So really get in the mindset of thinking century-wide, not this decade or whether or not SCO fails. Make sure that a SCO never happens. Make sure that everything that happens is done in a way that's not interrupted by the legal infrastructure or the mega corporations that would rather that sort of community-focused environments and sharing not happen. We've got to fight that so that we can get to the new enlightenment of, at least in computer science and maybe even everything, with the way that the internet is changing our lives. That's pretty much all I have. There's some URLs there if you want to check out more information, and I'm happy to take questions. This is Jim Garrison, who also works with me at the Software Freedom Law Center. I'm going to let him pick whoever wants to ask. So you get to decide what hand to go to. He's got a mic too. So this saves me from having to pick. Is it on? Oh. Oh well. This was a good idea, but. Uh, The question is whether there's a distinction between the projects who made, but you're saying we made a strong plan or got lucky? Is that what you're asking? Maybe I don't understand the question.
Yes, if someone approaches you and says, hey, we want your help because we're getting sued or because we think that someone else is using our code, would you treat differently someone that was negligent or ignorant and didn't do due diligence versus someone that tried to do things the way that you advise it to?
Well, I think you're asking whether we run away screaming from clients that look scary. Yeah. I don't think we've been put in that situation yet. I can tell you that, first of all, I'm not a lawyer. I'm sort of the guy at the SFLC who translates between legalese and hackerese. I'm like halfway in between. But I can tell you that we have always picked clients up until now based on their strategic importance in the free software world. So if you have the 800th MP3 player on SourceForge and you come to us with a legal question, we might turn you down simply because we don't want to represent 100 MP3 players. But if you have Linux or some sort of really important project and you come to us and ask for help, we're much more likely to accept you as a client. And we have to be a little bit discriminatory because we're giving services away for free, which means people knock on the door and ask for it. So we try to pick projects that are really important as far as for the future of free software. That's part of what my job is, to sort of tell the lawyers, yes, this project's really important, no, it's not. So if you have a project that you want represented, you probably have to convince me first, I think. And then I'll go and convince the lawyers to take you. Yeah, Jim has the mic, so he's picking who. Where did you go, Jim? I kind of find you. Oh.
Sorry. I actually had a question about the RIAA lawsuits. And particularly, why are those lawsuits failing? Because you would think that because they are the copyright owner, that they would actually be successful in these lawsuits. But yet, as you're saying, that they're mainly failing. So can you discuss kind of why that is?
Well, I will start out by answering the question by saying I am not a lawyer, so I'm not giving an answer that's actual legal analysis. But my layperson's understanding of how it works is that generally, law is actually made in a really reasonable way. Courts don't tend to do things that make no sense at all. I mean, some people see decisions and are like, why is this decision so crazy? But generally, courts will not do something that's totally out of field. And the whole idea that there are so many people infringing these copyrights, I think it's unlikely that courts are going to stand for the copyright system working this way. The general question might be a better question for an organization like EFF, who's actually trying to deal with the day-to-day litigation of these suits. I just sort of noticed they're failing and have thoughts about the implications for free software in that regard. But the EFF is sort of the organization that's really working on a day-to-day basis that could probably give you better analysis than my hand-waving that I just did. Go ahead.
I know this is probably a complex question, so just a two-minute answer. If we're starting a project, what is the most important things we can do to keep our legal ducks in a row?
So when you start a project, the first thing you have to worry about are copyrights, because that's what you're actually generating. When you start fixing work in tangible medium, as the statute says, that's when you get a copyright in something. So when you start typing your editor, you have a copyright on that. So the first thing you have to decide as a project is how you want to inventory your copyrights, i.e. keep track of who has copyrights on what. There's basically two methods to do this, generally. One is we recently dubbed the file-by-file copyright inventory, which is sort of the traditional way. And the other one is the single copyright file at the top of the directory. The key problem with the first one, which is the most common, is that people are not very good about it. So somebody sends you a patch, if it's a copyrightable work, which it usually is, their name has to go to the top of the file that they patched as a copyright holder in that work. Which means if we actually followed the file-by-file method in the right, legally correct way, there would be tons of names at the top of every single file. That's not actually a bad thing. We can page it out. We can use editors to hide it when we don't want to see it. So I think if you're using the file-by-file method, you have a lot more work to do than you might have realized, or if you just look at the projects that are out there that do this. Most projects have this problem because most use file-by-file and they don't do it very well. The other way to do it is with the single copyright file, which has a lot of advantages because you just have to add the person's name to one single file every time they do a contribution and put a simple stub header in each one that says, you know, see the top level copyright file for copyright details and licensing information. We've been trying to promulgate a little bit that idea of doing it that way. It's so antithetical to the way it's been done in the past that it's difficult to get people to switch over. But I would love to see projects actually tackle this issue and write policies about it and that sort of thing, which really projects don't do at their start. And we're going to try to promulgate some information to help projects. We just did a white paper that's on our website last week about how to do this thing when you have like ISC licensed software and you want to put GPL software with it. How do you do that? How do you keep the copyright notices in place correctly? So we have a white paper about that. We're going to be doing more white papers like that as time goes on to try and help projects learn how to do this. So I don't know who has the mic, so stand up, whoever has the mic, and speak.
I just wondered, how do you keep a proprietary software organization such as, say, Microsoft, using GPL code from that perspective?
How do you keep them from violating GPL?
Closed source code, so.
Oh, so how do you find out if they're violating?
Right. Like, they're not going to disclose their code, obviously.
Well, I don't know about Microsoft. I think Microsoft is smart enough not to try to violate GPL software. And certainly if somebody tries to obfuscate or otherwise hide that they're violating, it does become difficult. I've done a lot of GPL enforcement in my life, and my general feeling is that GPL violators are pretty stupid. Every time I've done a violation case, every time, and I've done hundreds at this point, if you run strings-a on the binary and grep for the word copyright, you will find the copyright holder's name. And it will turn out to be something like Free Software Foundation or Eric Anderson and Rob Landley of the BusyBox Project. If that doesn't work, just grep for some common symbols that are in the project and they'll be there. Certainly if somebody goes to a lot of effort to try and hide that they're infringing your copyrights, it's really hard to find out. And then you have to go to things like, you know, seeing if the thing acts like the other thing. But it tends to be the case that they just don't try that hard. Most GPL infringement is confusion about what they need to do, and it's really a teaching moment to try to teach them. Whoever's got the mic, stand up and speak.
Bradley, I have some bad news for you. It's true that the music industry is not litigating against people who are copying software. Instead, as of last month, they're actually going to college students in various colleges and threatening them that either they pay $4,000 as a penalty or $3,000 or various amounts of money, or else they will take them to court and charge them so much per song. And so a lot of the college students consent to this rather than actually go to court and litigate. So they're still out there, it's just using blackmail.
Yeah, I had heard about that. It is a huge problem, and I agree with you about that. It is bad news. But I kind of look at these things on the 20 to 50 year time frame, and I think in that time frame there's going to be a lot less of it. Yes, it's very bad for the college students who gets caught right now doing that, and then, you know, gives in to this kind of thing. My answer to that really is okay. So this is sort of some social political commentary that I probably shouldn't make, but most music today from the major labels sucks.
Okay, so
go to the independent musicians who are selling on things like eMusic, where I think it's called eMusic, I can't remember, I don't listen to music anymore because most of it sucks. But there's sites now that are selling, you know, DRM-free files. You know, I have this interesting story about, the one thing I do listen to is a lot of sort of, talk shows and those kind of things, and I'm a big fan of This American Life with Ira Glass, and he's gotten into this DRM thing, right? So at one point I was trying to figure out how to get a DRM unencumbered copy of a particular show that I missed. And I had a price in my head that I was willing to pay for that DRM unencumbered thing. And it started at pay $2 right now if I could get this thing. And I kept looking and trying to find it, and they have audible.com, which is all DRM'd up. And I'm like, oh, that sucks, I can't do that. That won't work on my Neuros, you know, and so forth. So I'm going through all this stuff. And finally, you know, my price keeps going up. I was willing to pay at one point $25 just to be done with this problem. And I got to about an hour of work and maybe $50, and then I finally said, I'm just gonna circumvent the DRM, which is what I did. And I think that over time, that's going to be the change. That people are going to realize that giving DRM encumbered performance, trying to stop file sharing, is not going to work for them, and it's actually better for them. That's the things like what NBC is doing. It's like they don't really care about file sharing of NBC shows because they know that people will eventually watch the first time it airs. Where's the mic at? Can whoever has it stand up? Yeah.
Hi, this is actually a two-part question relative to GPL version 3. There seems to be a lot of discussion about the fact that GPL version 3 is paying a lot more attention to hardware or freedom to use certain hardware, for instance, T-boization. I'm not sure where that notion came from, but there seems to be a lot of discussion and it's more concerned about hardware now, freedom to use the hardware versus the software portion. That's part one of my question. Part two of the question is this whole idea of service, software as a service, relative to companies like Google, for instance, who had built their strength off of the seminal open source software, free software, and now they've developed that strength, they pretty much closed up a lot of things that aren't sharing. Not that they're bad people, but you know, eventually that has to be dealt with or addressed. What is the Free Software Foundation and your organization actually doing to protect us on that?
Well, I should start by saying the last thing first, I don't speak for the Free Software Foundation anymore. They are just a client of the law firm that I work for. I want to be clear about that because I used to speak for the Free Software Foundation. This is why I can say open source now, if you hadn't realized. The first question, I think, is an important one. First of all, I don't like the phrase TiVoization at all, partly because TiVo was actually a GPL violator back in the day when I was doing the GPL enforcement work at FSF, and they actually worked really hard to come into compliance with version 2, and they did a really good job at coming into compliance. They were sort of a model citizen as far as version 2 goes. Of course, they discovered this would-be loophole in version 2, that, well, they can lock down and make the device not work when it happens. I think the reason there's so much attention to that given, and I can't speak for FSF, but I think as a community, we're giving it a lot of attention because of the DRM issue. Because DRM is sort of the biggest sort of collision course threat to open source and free software, because you just can't do DRM and make your product open source or free software. So the goal in GPLv3 is try to make sure that GPLv3 works don't get used in a DRM-based system as much as is possible with the license. Now, I actually have a different personal view about this. I think that the DRM is dying, as I sort of talked about in my talk, and I'm glad the stuff's in there for v3 to sort of make sure people don't try to do DRM with v3. But I think over time, what's going to happen is people are going to switch to things like MythTV. I was listening to the MythTV talk today, and now the guys who are doing the guide service are now just charging for the guide service, and people who have MythTV are buying it. The whole reason TiVo wants to lock you in is so they can lock you into their service agreement. Well, if there's a third party offering service for MythTV, and as MythTV gets better and better, we'll just have that, and we'll pay the money to the company that's willing to do the service in a free way. Free in the sense of allowing the software to be free, and you pay them for the guide service, which is fine. I think that's great, and I think that's likely what's going to happen. Now, as to the second part of your question about software as a service, this is a really important personal issue to me, and part of it's a little bit of, I have to admit, it's a little bit of ego. The one part of GPLv3 that I actually invented was not put into GPLv3. So I had this conversation with Eben Moglen in 2003, and I was like, nobody ever looks closely at section 2C of GPLv2, which has this it's a weird requirement, actually, when you read it. It's like, if the program you have prints out a copyright notice and a license information, then you are not allowed to change that in future versions. So it's actually a restriction on modification that makes sure that people downstream from you are told by the software that they have certain rights under the GPL. And it's an example of restricting very, very narrow way the right of modification to protect some more important freedom issue. Well, I had this idea, so why don't we make a section 2D that says, if your program runs as a service to users over a network connection, then you have to provide a link that allows them to get source code, and when you modify it, you're required to make that link work to send the modified source. And I thought this was a pretty neat idea, and Eben actually liked it, and it was all going to be in GPLv3, because back when we first started talking about GPLv3, and now it's 2004, I guess, when we were first talking about it, that was the big thing we were going to do. We're going to solve the software as a service problem. And in the end, the community sort of didn't want that in v3. And there was all this pushback when it went out in the first draft of V3. And I felt pretty bad about it, because it's like the one part of V3 I invented and nobody likes it. But the good news is that there's a thing called the Affero GPL, which is actually getting into its final version right now. And it's probably going to be released within a month. FSF sets that schedule, and I don't work there anymore, so I don't know their exact schedule. But very soon, Affero GPL is going to be released. It has this clause that I've just described in it, and it's a license compatible with GPL v3, which means you can take GPL v3 stuff, you can take Affero stuff, and the Affero clause applies to both, which is really excellent. So I hope people will adopt the Affero GPL. I'm a big fan of it, and this is more me speaking personally because, I invented the Affero idea more than anything else. But I think it's a great license, and I am worried about Google. I think Google and software as a service is really a really big threat to open source and free software, because if people really want, and I don't know why they want this, to give all their spreadsheet data and all their document data and all their email and all their everything else to Google to hold on their servers and search as they will and give them advertising based on it, for some reason people actually like this feature. I don't understand why. You can't even use your computer if you're not on a network. But if that's what people want, I think we have to find a way to require these companies to share that software back if they base it on stuff that we produce. And that's what I think Affero GPL really does. Where's the mic at? Stand up. If you have a mic, stand up.
Hi, I was wondering, is it conservancy just for projects, or can Lux also apply for it?
We thought about that question pretty hard, and we really wanted to focus it on just actual projects writing open source and free software. But I also think I didn't mention when I talked about the conservancy. I want the conservancy to be an exportable idea. I don't want like the conservancy to have all the FOSS projects in the world. What I want, and we're trying to design, is a transparent system that you can clone, and you can set up your own conservancy. And the Perl Foundation has already talked to us. They're interested in setting up a conservancy-like thing for Perl projects, and we think that's great, and we're going to try to give them as much help as we can. There should be lots of different conservancies that provide services to all sorts of different projects, and I think a lug-based conservancy would be an excellent idea, and if you want to talk about it after, I'm happy to give you some ideas.
Yeah, one last question.
One last, okay. You can pick the lucky one. That way I don't have to be a bad guy.
Right. I want you guys to play games.
they have a World Series of Rochambeau, it's pretty cool. Go ahead.
So my question, I think you mentioned it briefly, was the issue recently with the BSD guys and the wireless drivers and the GPL modifications, the modifications by some Linux hackers and the changing of the copyright. I never heard what the final outcome of that was, and were you guys involved with that at all, and what was your views on that?
Oh, great. You should have both done Rock then, right? Actually, the Linux Wireless team is a client of SFLC. We actually released three documents this week. We made this joke that we treated the internet like a big truck, not a series of tubes, because we just dumped these three documents right out there. But they explain the whole situation, what happened. I can briefly tell you, one of the developers really wanted his code to be GPL'd. So originally it had the GPL on it. We did some negotiation and talked to all the developers, and in the end they decided what we actually want to do is cooperate with the OpenBSD guys. So we've helped them put the whole thing under the ISC license now. John Linville is going to give a try at maintaining it as ISC licensed in the kernel. It's a difficult thing to do, and if you read one of our documents, it talks about, if you have a GPL project and you want to keep some subset under the ISC license, how do you do it? It's complicated. It's got legal details that have to be worked out, but they want to give it a go. They want to share back. I think the Linux Wireless guys are just great guys. They really want to help out. And, it's really unfortunate that this happened. I think most of it came down to miscommunications between the OpenBSD team and Linux Wireless. And like it happens in our community, people get upset and then they're screaming, they send emails at 4 a.m. and say things they don't really mean. And it's a sad thing to see when hackers fight like that. But I think it's all sorted out, and I think it's a really good outcome. And the nice thing about it for us is we were able to produce, like I was saying before, some of these excellent documents that really help people understand, the issue of, how to do some of this work. And we want to produce more documents like that in the future. Thank you all. I appreciate it.
Okay, we have a few things to wrap up here. I believe we're going to draw for us.